Well, my name is Tyler Burr, and this is Lo-Fi Lit. And if you don't know what Lo-Fi Lit is, this is a podcast hosted by me, where I interview writers, authors, poets, and people who run presses, all who converge upon the internet, all of whom converge. Today we're talking to Aaron Birch. He started Hobart, a literary magazine, in 2002. He also is the author of many books, including Year of the Buffalo, also a kind of in-between miniature essays. He's also comprised an anthology of 20 track essays about writing, none of which ever mention writing, which includes an essay by James Brubaker. He also runs HAD. Very positive fellow. He grew up in Tacoma, Washington. Also the author of the memoir Literary Analysis, Stephen King's The Body. Many other adventures and many other projects, some of which we may reach, some of which we may not. He also hosts a gathering of people over Zoom to talk about short stories and the short stories that he likes. And I open up the podcast by talking about that and actually pointing out the fact that he is sitting in a different room than the last time I remember seeing him. And that's where we will begin the show. And that's what you are going to hear, me asking him and me pointing out that he is in a different room than the one I remember from before. This is Lo-Fi Lit. Welcome to the show. I hope you enjoyed this episode. You're in a different room from last time, I remember, because I went and took the... You had a short story group?
Yeah. Yeah, I do that. I like being up here better, so I'm up in this, like, upstairs loft area. But sometimes the internet gets a little... This is, like, the furthest place from the router in the house, and so especially when there's like 30 of us on one of those or whatever, it starts to cut in and out.
Do you live with 30 people?
No, I mean like the 30 in the short story group.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if it matters actually how many people are in that and in my internet, but maybe it just seems like extra embarrassing when I'm trying to host.
You thought about recording that?
A little bit. I kind of like the sort of like... ephemeral nature of it. Like you can, you know, it's kind of a bummer. I have a handful of friends who would love to make it but can't always, and I think especially with the first one being the Dennis Johnson one, I think there were people who were like, oh, I'd really be curious to listen. I'm not sure that I say anything smart enough that's worth listening
to. I think
after
the
fact.
Your enthusiasm. I mean, you guys said something like really interesting. You had a lot of background information that added to like how the story that we had read, it really added to it. And I think people would listen to something like that.
Yeah, probably. I think some of it is, I kind of like it being a hangout rather than something that I'm like trying to, you know, promote and pitch and be like,
do you think it would change if you did record it? Cause like the hangout thing is like exactly what I want on a podcast. Like that's exactly what I want. Do you think if you did like sit down and record it, like you, like just internally, you would like,
I bet change. It would be the same. I bet I would just forget, right? I mean, that's what typically happens on a podcast is like within 5 or 10 minutes, you usually kind of forget and you're just chatting. I don't know. The flip side of it is just, I don't know that I would change so much as like, I think there is a lost enjoyment in the kind of like ephemeral, right? I mean, I've been thinking about versions of that a bunch recently with having done this like kettlebell book with Kevin and DT. And like maybe at some point we'll print some more, but it was like we printed 50 and then they're gone and now they're gone. And like, yeah. I kind of like it's just sort of being like, we're not trying to sell it or anything. It's just like was a fun thing and then it's out there, which is kind of the short story club too, right? It's just like, it's a fun chat for an hour or two.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. Because like a lot of things, I guess I would just, why I would want it on a podcast. You don't have to do one. I'm going to do one. But like a lot of the podcasts on short stories or even poetry, they're so formal.
Yeah.
And so, it just feels, you don't get that enjoyment. Like everything's so slowed down, almost deadpan, and you don't hear the enthusiasm or the fandom come through people's voices because like people are most afraid to even express something that's informal or just express that's in the moment. So I do like the ephemeral thing that you're talking about.
I think you get caught up on like trying to be smart too, or like, you know, thinking that that's what people want. And,
yeah.
I mean, I think about that too with podcasts where I listen to a couple podcasts where like every now and then the host will do like a, will have like a prepared thing, right? It's sort of like an audio essay.
Yeah.
And I feel like as soon as I can tell that's what it is, I just like don't care, right? I'm just like, oh, I could read this. I don't have any interest in you just like reading an essay to me. I kind of want to just listen to people chat and hang out.
Yeah, I think from the host side, they feel like they have to provide that. Like that's a fear or an anxiety, I think, from the host side. Like I have to sit down and write something to give it to the audience. So you like short stories. What's your favorite short story?
I don't know, although sort of maybe I'll get there in a circuitous way. So I've been thinking about some of the podcasts I'm listening to right now are doing these like 25 for 25, right? Which is like a classic, just like excuse for content. But like a good button or hook or whatever. It's just like, oh, it's 2025. Let's do the best 25 movies of the century so far, or whatever. And I was just in the last day or two thinking about some super informal laid back version of that on like some combo of short story long or my personal Substack would be fun. I feel like reaching out to all the contributors and just asking everybody like, what's your favorite, and or give me like a list of a handful of favorite stories of the century and kind of compiling that.
Would you pitch that to Zona? Have you seen Zona Motel?
I don't know what that is.
That's with Julia Escoria, Lucy
Fishbaugh,
Graham Irvin. They have all these writers like writing for one thing on Substack.
No, I didn't like, I think, I mean, it feels like, it feels related enough for short story long, or I would probably just throw it up there. And I think I'm thinking of like taking a break from publishing new stories for 4 or 6 weeks. And so then a part of me too was like, oh, that feels like a way of kind of like having some kind of regular update. And maybe trying to encourage community through it too. It's like, there's a handful of people who are commenting on short story longs and stuff like that. But not a ton. But a part of me too was wondering like, oh, if I start doing, you know, people love commenting on lists, right? And so maybe that might be part of too, like, oh, what did you think about that so-and-so author loved this one, or what are your recommendations? But
I've seen a real push for people trying to bring back like the comment section, like, because they're inspired by like HTML Giant, because like we don't see that enough. And I've seen a big push for that to come back.
Yeah, I think social media kind of like took the place of it. And then I think with social media kind of like dispersing, and I don't know, it feels like saying it dying is an overblown statement, but certainly like diminished from, you know, a year, 2 years, 5 years ago. And so it does feel like there's a way of, I think a lot of us are sort of like, how do I recapture some of what felt so exciting 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 20 years ago. And some of that is thinking about blogging and thinking about, you know, comment sections and stuff like that, I think.
So what was something magical that was 20 years ago?
I mean, 20 years ago was kind of like when I started all of this, right? And so I think it was, I mean, incredibly like magical for me to like, because I think it just changed my life. Like, you know, 1999 to 2000 was like when I discovered lit journals, when I started Hobart, when I started reading and writing for pleasure myself. And so just for me, I think, and probably everybody has a version of this, right? Whenever, whatever is your formative thing, you know?
So what lit journals were you reading before you started Hobart?
Yeah, so McSweeney's was the big one. And I think that's what made it, I think McSweeney's is really important in making it magical, not just for me, but for like early 2000s too. And so I think the personal attachment is like how much it meant to me in that, that point in my life, being just newly post-college and trying to figure out the world. But then McSweeney's had blown up and Dave Eggers had blown up. And so I think there was this moment in time where like indie experimental nerdy literature was like cool in a way that it so seldom is, right? And so I think that brought a lot of us to kind of the scene and made a lot of us aware of lit journals in ways that maybe in the 90s and 80s and earlier maybe had much more only been had been more academic, I think, in that like, you know, 01, 02, I think there were a lot of us just like goofballs who were on the internet for the first time in our life. Mm-hmm. McSweeney's was cool and visible. And then also in those years was kind of like the first time that all of this stuff was mass accessible. So like desktop publishing made it possible for some dork like me in my bedroom to print books, and like that that wouldn't have even been possible, but like, you know, I got a pirated bootleg copy of like Quark Express and like taught myself how to format a book and put out print issues of Hobart.
Oh damn. And so like early mags though, like iShot.net, like that's
so places. iShot was huge for me. So I think it started with McSweeney's and then spread from there. So like iShot was my first publication and they were really big.
How long were you reading them before you sent a story out? Where do you get the like enthusiasm?
Probably not that long. I mean, I think a year or two. And
are you in college? And like,
so I'm just out of college.
Okay.
So in college, I never really knew what I was doing in college. I took one class that in 2000 taught me basic HTML. Right. So in 2000, really? This was like pre.
That's pretty far. That's pretty advanced.
Yeah. It was like,
I haven't even taken a class that ever taught me that.
Yeah. So it changed my life. Like I don't like college as somebody who never figured out what he wanted to do with his life or even barely what he wanted to major in, like college was just a lot of hanging out and uncertainty.
Yeah.
And then I just stumbled into this one class that taught me how to build a website. And I was like, this is fun. And then I graduated college and didn't know what I was doing with my life and was working in a bank. It was like, how do I fill non-banking hours of my life? Like, what are my interests? What do I do? How do I be a human? I kind of didn't know yet, you know?
Yeah.
I was like, I took this one class where I learned how to build a website, and that was really fun. It's like, okay, I'll do that. And then building a website kind of just like accidentally became building a lit journal. But it really started with wanting to just design a website more than it started like wanting to edit a lit journal.
How did it become was it anything before a lit journal?
No, but I think, you know, I was 23. Did you even
know, well, I guess you did know what a lit journal was, but yeah.
But kind of like barely, right? And all of this was kind of colliding at the same time. So I kind of knew what a lit journal was from McSweeney's. And then was sort of finding iShot, Pindledy Boz, Sweet Fancy Moses, Hey Penny, Opium.
Was Juked around?
Juked, I think, was either around either then or within a couple years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Surgery of Modern Warfare, which was Amy Fusselman's website. And so I was kind of like finding all of those. I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I was starting to read and kind of starting to write for pleasure for the first time in my life. And via a bunch of those, right? Stuff that I was reading on McSweeney's and then iShot and Pendlebury Buzz was often like this short stuff that felt really fun. And I think that's what really drew me to it. Like, I wasn't a giant reader in high school or college. Yeah, not really.
Oh, wow.
I think I kind of discovered it throughout college. But then I was just reading these short, weird pieces, right? And they were like weird and funny and had this like energy to them. And they seemed like understandable enough that I could grab hold of it. Unlike maybe trying to read poetry and being like, I don't get it. It was like, I get it, but also not completely. And so it was just mysterious enough to have an appeal, right? Like it would keep rattling. And so I think at some point, I think probably in my teens and 20s, thought of myself in my friend group as like a funny guy and a storyteller. And so some part of me was like, can I put this on the page? Can I write something that feels as entertaining as this thing that I just read on Pindledy Boz or iShot was.
After you publish like your first piece on like Pindledy or iShot, are people like reaching out to you? Is there a community forming?
A little bit. So there's a community. I think I was just talking about this with a couple other guys recently. There was these Zoetrope workshops, which I think maybe technically still exist, although I haven't looked in that website in a decade or much longer.
It wasn't that like a movie thing?
Yeah. So it was like Francis Ford Coppola, and he started this magazine called Zoetrope, and then he started an online component, which again, in like 2001, it was just kind of like unheard of and unlike anything else. And rather than it being an online journal, it was like a kind of community-based writing workshops, kind of. And so it just had like a giant message board, and you would like upload stories, and then for every five other people's stories that you reviewed, you could upload one of your own, and then other people would give you feedback. So that was really my first experience with receiving any feedback and getting anybody like reading.
So you took one. You took a workshop.
Yeah, so it wasn't even like you take one, because I guess it wasn't really like it was like workshopping, but not like workshops, because there was no like instruction or anything. It was just like a big giant kind of message board. And then you just like upload a story, and then other people just like would read it and give feedback. And then tied to that, you could have these rooms. And so people would form rooms and then chat with each other. Right. So my first entree into like the literary world and a community was through there, and was starting to meet, a bunch of writers through that.
Are there still people writing that you met through there?
Yeah, I mean, I met Elizabeth through there.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Or if not through there, then there was also like another message board on the Atlantic Monthly that was like a bunch of online journal editors and writers.
Okay.
And so like Whitney Pastorek at Pindledy Boz was on this Atlantic Monthly message board, and like a handful of those kinds of people. And so that was like, I started chatting with them. That felt like, you know, pre-social media, that meant a ton for getting out Hobart awareness. It was like, I don't know how to find writers. Oh, I can post in this message board that there's a new issue live.
So did you ever think about doing that with Hobart?
No, because being in charge of that wasn't really like...
Okay.
where my interests lay, right? Like I figured out relatively early on that I just like love working with writers and publishing writers and promoting them, and like facilitating a message board is not really my
So was it
my
your
back.
first, the first Hobart, was that difficult to like get people to come to?
I think yes and no. I think it was difficult in that I had no idea how to, and I had no writer connections, and there wasn't really social media. I think it wasn't difficult because I didn't really give a shit.
Yeah.
I had no way of knowing how many people read it, and I kind of didn't care, right? And I was just like, I don't know, I'm publishing this thing because it's fun, and it seems like enough people are reading it where I'm getting submissions. And that's kind of like, that was the real only, like, one of the main feedback loops was just what people would tell you about your journal in emails when submitting it. Because I'm not getting, you know, Twitter likes or retweets or anything. Like, I don't know if anybody's reading it. But then, you know, when somebody submits, they're sort of, they'll say something kind about the journal. And I'm like, okay, this is meaning something to somebody.
What was your rejections like?
They were like real doofusy. I mean, you know, this was all sort of pre-submittable and everything, so it was all just email. And the early days of Hobart was like, I had recently been broken up and had moved away from home, and I took my first creative writing class at like an adult learning place, mostly just like, how do I fill 25-year-old heartbroken hours where I'm like living on my aunt's couch. And so I met one other dude also in his mid-20s, and he would come over and hang out with me, and we would just like eat donuts and drink a bunch of whiskey and like work on the journal together.
That's awesome.
And so it was super fun. I'm sure looking back, some of those emails were like maybe not full on inappropriate, but like probably not the most professional.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Those early days, did you meet anyone that you're still working with?
I mean, so one of the reasons why I've been thinking about this a bunch lately is on Short Story Long. Just last week, I published a story by John Leary. And this amazing story, and he just submitted it. And I think I first published him in a print issue of Hobart in 2003. I was in Zoetrope with him. I haven't really kept up with him. I didn't totally know that he was still writing. And then he sent me the story, and I was just like, holy shit, this story is great. And also, how cool to hear from this guy from, you know, from forever ago. Sort of similarly, I think maybe two summers ago, I did like a little Midwest reading tour of like 3, 4, or 5 cities with this guy, Jim Ruland. And he's another guy that I know from those early like Opium, Pendlebury Vaz, Hobart, Zoetrope days. So
like,
yeah.
The early design of Hobart, like, how'd you, I guess, come up with it?
Yeah, I mean, when it started, it had monthly issues. And so I would like update an issue on the first of every month. And I think the very first conception was like, I was really modeling it on a print journal. And I think the earliest design had kind of like two columns with like a blurry line down the middle that was kind of supposed to look a little bit like a book fold crease. Mm-hmm. And it was really sort of like thinking about it like that. And then it kind of, you know, I think the design was a lot just, I've always really liked graphic design and not been great at it, but been okay at it. And so a lot of the early design was me looking at other journals and then also just websites that maybe weren't online journals, but I liked the look of, and just borrowing from this and borrowing from that. And then what are my HTML coding skills like up to? And it's like, well, I really like the look of that site, but I can't actually do that, but I can do this.
How much did a website cost to make back then?
So I had one of my like college roommate buddies like went into tech, and at the time he and one of his buddies started this like web hosting company.
Oh shit.
And so they just like hosted Hobart for free for me. on this like buddy plan for, you know, 5 years or something.
Lucky of you, dude.
Yeah. So it was a lot of like, you know, I figured out how to design websites because my brother like got me a bootleg copy of book design. And then like I had a web hosting, free web hosting. And so none of it was really costing me anything, which was a real sort of gift and privilege. And it was just like, just my time.
How much would it have cost if you?
I don't even know. I mean, I don't think it was that much. I don't know. You have to sort of like buy the URL, and that costs, I don't know what, anywhere from 15 to 50 bucks a year, something like that. And then mm-hmm. and then web hosting was probably not that much, but
well, like when you're a 25-year-old, like living on your own, not maybe making that much. I just don't know. Now it's like $200-$300 a year.
Yeah, I think. I mean, it was if it's that now, it was probably $100 to $200 then. Damn. Probably didn't really have $100 to $200, and you know, when I'm 25, and
you're just hustling.
Yeah, pretty much. And then sort of the. And I think. I didn't and still don't have that many, if any, other hobbies that I like put money toward. I like, mm-hmm. you know, I like eating and drinking out with friends and I like travel, but I'm not really like buying shit. I'm not really like collecting anything and so I think for a lot of my life, I have sort of just assumed that putting some money into a journal was kind of like my version of my labor of love hobby. And it's just like, well, I don't give a shit about like cars and fixing up cars, but like instead of buying, you know, a new bumper, I'll sort of like spend this money on web hosting or whatever.
How did you come to the decision to end the print mag?
I think at the time it was probably a little bit of a co-decision between Elizabeth and I, and I think it was just taking up so much time. I think the economics of it didn't totally make sense. But I think even more than the economics, it was just like, I'm spending a lot of time on this, and I'm getting to the point in my life where I no longer have my 20 something energy. Mm-hmm. And my time and energy feels a little bit more like I need to be a little bit more careful with it. And I think I'm not sure that we were like, okay, this is it, we're done. I think it was just like, well, let's take a little bit of a hiatus instead of trying to put the next issue out in 6 months, like we've been trying. And then often 6 months would become 8 or 10 or a full year. But like, instead of even shooting for that, let's like take some time off and then we'll come back when we come back. And then we took enough time off and was like, maybe we're just done.
Yeah. Is it more rewarding to publish like people's books than like a magazine? Or like, because if the economics, I guess, like people, not enough people are buying the magazine.
I don't know if it's more rewarding, but differently rewarding probably. Yeah. And there is, I mean, most small press books don't make any money either. But if you have one hit every now and then, it can. And like a lit journal is kind of like never gonna make any money. But if you have that one book that sort of gets enough word of mouth or something, then it will make its money back and then pay ideally even for the next few too. And
for you, that was probably women.
It was women. It was Big World before women. Yeah, I think those two. I think Fast Machine sold a bunch. I think women was really like, yeah.
Was that a shock?
I don't know. Like, I think shock is maybe an interesting word. I mean, sort of, it's a surprise when anything hits, right? It's such a small world, you know? It's like, I'm surprised when any, like, I both... You know, I care about all of this stuff so much mm-hmm. that like a part of me and I care about it and I just like love it and it brings me such pleasure and such joy. Yeah. And so I'm like, everybody else should too. Like if you guys want to have the joy that I have when I read a short story that I love, like like everybody should be doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of me thinks that. The other part of me is like very well aware that like 12 people care about short stories, you know? Mm-hmm. And so then when anything, and not even just short stories, but like, you know, in indie lit in any way. And so when anything does kind of catch, I don't know that it ever quite feels like a shock, but it does feel like, I don't know, feels like a fun wave to be riding, certainly, when you're, yeah, when you're like having to do another print run of a book because you sold out, or when you're, you know, seeing really glowing reviews, or seeing, you know, famous people like Instagramming about it or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's like, honestly, it feels pretty cool.
Are there some books you're like, this is going to be a huge hit?
And then no.
It doesn't happen. And then no.
I think we published, and then, you know, like the books were really Elizabeth's thing. So like I was helping out with them, but like, so she could talk much more about the books really. But like, I think there were a couple that we kind of like expected or hoped to catch on a little bit more and then just didn't. Mm-hmm. But also that's, you know, so it goes in the way of literature. Yeah.
So you're going to talk about your book, Year of Buffalo?
Sure.
So when did you start writing it?
So super long circuitous path, right? Which like when it happens to you, you're sort of like, oh man, this, the story of this book is so unique, so crazy. And then you start talking to other writers and you're like, oh, everybody's like, there is no normal path of a book. They're all crazy. Kind of. I mean, so I started, I wrote a novel in grad school, which was...
Oh, when did you go to grad school?
2008 to 2011.
So the choice to go to grad school. So you were doing Hobart, mm-hmm. you're doing the print mag. Was there like a negative thing around grad school for you in the community mm-hmm. as there is, you know, now people get all...
No, and I think, I mean, I just listened to, I don't know, I just listened to the Mike Young mm-hmm. Conversation. I think he said a version of this too. I think that same outsider negative opinion of it existed then, same as now. It's maybe more vocal now just because everything's more vocal now, I think. I think it still existed. I think it's kind of dumb. I didn't have any trepidations or sort of like negative opinions about them. I guess the sort of caveat to that is I did kind of with a chip on my shoulder, like that I didn't have one, right? Mm-hmm. I liked that at that point, I was like, I've been doing Hobart 6 or 7 years. We've built a pretty good name for it. I'm getting stuff published. I feel like we're publishing some like pretty big names and pretty great stories in Hobart. And I came into this without an MFA. My undergrad was not in English. I knew zero writers. And so I think some part of me was like, you know, I kind of did it. I did it from the outside in. And yeah. Then I loved my MFA experience, but a small part of me was like, man, I kind of liked that I was the outsider guy. And now I'm just another dumbass who has an MFA, who runs a journal and writes. Like,
but I mean, if you're like passionate about something and committed to something, I mean, it makes sense to go to higher education for it. Like it's kind of almost like a boot camp for that.
Yeah.
That you love.
And I loved it. It's just like, I mean, it's really, I think people on the outside looking in have a lot of like preconceptions and projections. And for me, it was real, just like a 3-year, like artistic bubble. You know, and you're just like kind of all you're doing and all of your life kind of consists of art or sort of writing, right? And like I'm doing writing, I'm going to school and talking about writing, I'm hanging out in the bar in the evenings with other students who are writers, and just kind of like everything feels like just, you know, this time in your life that seldom if ever gets to happen, that you don't have many other responsibilities, if any, other than just kind of like being an artist. And so like the classroom stuff for an MFA didn't mean that much to me. I think part of that was maybe program, part of that was maybe my mentality. Part of it was, again, like at that point, I was a little older than my cohort and had been doing Hobart longer. And I think I wasn't trying to find my voice in the way that some people kind of are. I think I got a lot better in those 3 years, but I was like, I kind of know what I think about writing already.
So what was the decision to go?
I wanted a break from my normal day job. I thought I might like to teach. And so you need one to teach. I didn't know. I was like, maybe I won't like teaching and I'll just come back and go back to my day job. I don't know. It's been a while now. I mean, Elizabeth and I were kind of like always on and off. And so applying might have even hit during an off phase, and it might have just been like another moment of like, what am I doing with my life? Maybe I'll go to grad school. Although maybe that wasn't the timing, and that's like in retrospect, looking back, I don't know.
Was she applying with you?
No.
So how did grad school turn out though? You said you liked it. And then you said you wrote the novel.
Yeah, so I liked it. I spent 2 years like writing short stories for workshop.
Mm-hmm.
And then our program, our third year was a thesis year. So you didn't have any classes. You just taught and worked on a thesis. Mm-hmm. So I met with my thesis advisor and was kind of like, oh, I could spend this year, working on really tightening these stories. And like, I could come out of here with like a real tight, solid story collection. Or I could spend the year working on a novel. And I thought she was going to be like, whatever you think you should do, you know? And she was like, do the novel. I was like, mm-hmm. Oh, all right. So, which was the best thing ever. So I spent that year writing a novel. And like,
are you writing every day?
Probably. Yeah. Okay. And I think probably, if not every day, certainly almost. Maybe every day, like going to the coffee shop, generally like writing at the coffee shop. And so like almost every day, going to the coffee shop for a couple hours, having a coffee and just like trying to knock out words. Yeah. And trying to make kind of constant forward progress.
So how'd it turn out?
Turned out not great.
What was it about?
I mean, so it was about two kind of friends who, well, they aren't really friends, but they have a friend in common, right? And so the friend in common kind of introduces them and they go on a road trip together across the country. So I thought it was kind of interesting. It never really had much of a plot or any kind of hook. It wasn't like, this is why they go across the country. It's just like, they just do. Mm-hmm. And I thought it had a bunch of like fun, interesting scenes. And because it was a road trip novel, it had some momentum. But like, and I think, you know, at the time when I was 33 and had written my first novel, I thought it turned out great. At some point looking back, I could really tell like, oh, it's not great. And these are kind of some of the reasons why, but this is the stuff in it that's good enough that did make me think it was great. Mm-hmm.
Like what?
I think just like some of the scenes and some of the banter, I think I had kind of like figured out kind of, how to,
like through the writing you learned way more than if you hadn't written anything.
Totally. And I think I figured out how and then I could write 200 pages instead of 20, right? Mm-hmm. And
did that seem like insurmountable before?
Kind of. Yeah. And a big part of why it was a road trip novel was it's kind of a linked story collection, right? Where like they're on a road trip and then they just like stop in a city and then some adventure happens in the city and then they drive to the next city and then something happens. I mean, I never thought about it as linked stories. I mean, the idea was a novel, but like it's a very episodic novel. And I think in part because I knew how to write stories and I was like, oh, I could write a story that like pushes the ball forward a little bit. And then the next chapter is like they pick up the ball and just push it a little further.
Would you ever rewrite it?
At some point, pieces of it became Buffalo.
Okay.
So that was kind of the, I think at some point I scrapped that novel. I spent a bunch of time writing another novel. And then after that novel, had this idea of these kind of like two brothers who don't really have much of a relationship, one of whom had spent a bunch of time wanting to become a professional wrestler. And then this video game comes out where his wrestling persona is like the main character in this video game. And mm-hmm. so this video game company like reaches out and pay him likeness rights. And so he gets this like windfall of money out of nowhere. And it's a little interesting or weird or fun because the windfall of money came specifically for the thing that he wanted to become famous for, but by this point in his life, he had left it behind, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, what does that mean, sort of, right? And so that's kind of the premise of Year of the Buffalo. And then the first, I don't know, third of the novel is that brother, the wrestling brother with that money, he and his wife kind of buy a farm and he invites his brother to come live with them and to kind of maybe like figure out why they don't have much of a relationship. And then they're on the farm for a while. And then as a writer, I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. I need some movement. It's like feeling a little stale or a little static. It's like, I need to put them on the road. It's like, I kind of have, I have this outline for how a road trip novel might work. So I ended up pulling a bunch of those chapters in and like everything got rewritten and it's like two brothers now instead of, you know, two friends or friends of friends. I think the grad school novel was like written in first person and Buffalo's in third. And it's like, but a lot of the bones are there where I'm sort of like, oh, it would be interesting if they drove from this city to that, like, and then just kind of like pulling in a lot of that banter and those scenes that I had always enjoyed about that grad school novel. And so a lot of that got repurposed.
What kind of car?
I forget, but they, I think they rent something. And I think the wrestling brother's wife kind of like surprises them by like being like, oh, I rented you this like big fancy SUV to sort of like as a treat for your road trip.
What does the road trip like, how does that draw you in? What do you find alluring about that?
So I think it just like, I think it does a couple of opposite things at once. Like it traps them in a car. So it's like, oh, they have to deal with their shit now. Right. Like I think in the beginning of the novel, they're sort of like circling each other, but also avoiding each other because they're like, we don't really know how to talk to each other. And so you put them on the road and you're like, well, you can only not talk to your road trip partner for so long. And then at some point you're like, okay, let's hammer shit out. Or at least like, if we're not hammering shit out, we're like talking about other shit by avoiding this instead of just like locking myself in the bedroom or whatever mm-hmm. on the farm. And so it does that. But then also, I think it gives the book and me as the writer when working on it some momentum and some progress, right? And so instead of just like sitting here, they're moving. And now in this novel, unlike the grad school novel, unless the grad school novel had one and I'm forgetting, but like this one has a purpose. So they're living in like Washington State. And there's like this video game conference that's going to be in Detroit, and the video game company want the wrestler to like come be at that as part of this like unveiling of their new game to promote it. So he's like, cool. Instead of flying out, me and my brother are going to drive there and that'll be our thing. So it gives them an end goal. And also like now they can have a bunch of adventures along the road.
Did you do research into like wrestling video games?
A little bit. I think the cheat of the novel is that isn't really what it's about.
Yeah.
Right. It sort of is kind of like background more than foreground.
Yeah.
I think I had a lot of interest in wrestling and video games growing up. And then one of my primary themes is nostalgia. And so the book is definitely like drawing on that, but I haven't played a video game in, you know, I don't know, 20 years, and I haven't like watched wrestling in 30 or 40.
Yeah. Right? Who was your favorite?
I mean, at the time it was sort of like, you know, Ultimate Warrior and Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant and Scorpion, was that his name, right?
The Sting.
So kind of like all those guys.
Do you recall any of Ultimate Warrior's like promos?
A little bit, not specifically, but like I feel like I fuzzily remember them.
Can you explain?
Not really. Was it just the yelling, or was it?
He's like yelling about spaceships coming down and shit.
Yeah.
He's like clearly on cocaine.
Yeah, and then I think in my mind too, I have kind of like conflated some of those with like Ric Flair yelling, right? And like I know they're different, but in my mind they're all just like wrestling guys, like probably all coked up and yelling.
Do you see yourself as like the Ric Flair of like online lit?
No, I don't think I'm. No. That'd be kind of interesting if you do or if somebody does. I don't think I'm that.
Who do you think is?
The Ric Flair. I mean.
Maybe Gian was.
Maybe.
Did you ever meet him?
I did. Yeah. I met him a few times. In New York. I think maybe always in New York. I want to say I met him at an AWP one year, but it might have been the New York AWP.
Is that where you meet everyone?
Yeah, pretty much. That's kind of what I so love about it, too. It's like the writing conference aspect doesn't mean that much to me, but it becomes epicenter of getting to meet everybody. Yeah.
Would you ever make your own?
No.
Okay.
It feels like an amount of work that I don't want to do. And again, kind of like not my skill set, right? Like organizing things and planning is not my skill set. I think I'm more...
Even though you make like magazines, you make so many magazines.
Yeah.
Like HAD and all this other stuff.
Yeah, I think I've figured out how to do magazines that use my skills, right? Mm-hmm. And then also, and kind of, and then both too, how to build them toward what I'm good at, both what I'm good at and what I want to do, right? Is I think that's at the crux of it too, is sort of like, here's the aspects of doing a journal that I like. How do I build a journal that like front loads that? I think like calling up event spaces and like feeling like that's, I don't want to do that.
Yeah. So what's your favorite short story?
So it's not my favorite, but the one that I kicked off that was awesome short story club was that Dennis Johnson, the title story, The Largesse of the Sea Maiden. And so that would certainly be up there.
What do you like so much about short stories? What draws you to them?
I don't know.
Other than film or music.
I mean, I love film and music too. I think there's a few things. One is probably I can write a short story and I can't make music or make a movie. Part of that is like what I appreciate about them, I think, or I don't know quite like why that's the, like being able to do it also makes me love it, or like I'm not sure the connection there. It's maybe an interesting thing that I haven't quite thought about, but I thought I like music quite a bit and really loved music in my teens and 20s.
Maybe it's because you don't have to involve so many other people.
Yeah.
Like with a movie or music, you have to involve with like a band and communicating with people. With short stories, you can like sit down with a pencil and just like write away on a little pad.
Yeah. And I think a good short story will kind of do one of two things, and maybe ideally a great one will do both, which is that like it will notice something that I maybe have noticed or thought or believed before too, and it puts a spotlight on that, and so it's that, like, that glow of recognition, right? When a story, like, describes something and you're like, yes, that is what it felt like, what that thing looks like, what that. And so there's that element of, like, recognition and, like, the familiar. And then also, at the same time, will make me think something I've never thought before, right? And be like, and so I think a really good story could do either or of those, and maybe my absolute favorite stories do both, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe is one way of thinking about it, yeah.
So what draws you to the essay? Because you wrote the body book.
Yeah.
Based off your favorite movie or book?
Yeah, it's based on the novella. But like, yeah. My in was really that it's and I love the Stephen King novella, The Body, but like a big part of why I love it is because it was turned into Stand By Me, and I really love Stand By Me. So I kind of had a friend who was a Hobart contributor who reached out to me, and I'm not sure why he thought of me, because we weren't the closest friends. And, like, I don't know, I'm sure he knew writers who are better writers than me. But for whatever reason, he reached out to me and was like, a friend of his is starting this series that they were pitching as like 33 and a third, but for books, right? And so, like, short books, but not literary criticism, but instead, like, using the book to get into kind of some personal. You know, I think my knee jerk to him reaching out to me was just like, oh, I love to be asked. I'm honored. I don't really have any ideas, and I'm not that big of a nonfiction writer. And then the more I sat with it, and I was like, the books that, like, one of the books that I discovered in college that really made me a reader was Fight Club, right? And so, like, the first book that, like, jumped to mind was Fight Club. I was like, I don't really want to write a whole book about Fight Club. Like, mostly I just want to leave it there and be like, man, here was the thing that I loved when I was 20. And, like, that's it, the end. But then I kept thinking about it, and I was like, well, one of, if not the singular favorite movie of mine is Stand By Me. And it was based on a novella. And I think I could write a whole book about that, because I could write some about the movie. I could write some about the book. I've taught the book, so I could talk about, I could use it to talk about teaching. The movie and the book are about these four young friends, so I can use it to talk about my friends. It's about nostalgia, and that's one of my themes, so I can use it to talk about nostalgia. And so pretty quickly I was like, I don't know how to write 120 words of nonfiction, mm-hmm. but I can write 10 about the first time I saw the movie, and I can write another 10 about my best friend, and I can write another 10. And I was like, I'm pretty sure I could do that. Mm-hmm. So I kind of pitched that. I pitched it as being like, this is a little bit of a cheat, right? It's not, I am writing about a book, which is what your series is, but I'm really kind of backdooring writing about a movie.
So you had to break it down in your head.
Yeah.
Before you
and
could
I think,
do it.
And I think I had notes to myself, and then at some point, and I really wrote the chapters piecemeal, and then at some point I had a big, like, cork board in my apartment at the time, and I just kind of, you know, got a bunch of note cards and wrote down, like, everything that I had. And I was like, okay, here's the chapters that I have. What's missing? Like, how could I get from this chapter to that? What stuff that the book is, like, wrestling with that I'm not yet? How do I fill that in, and how do I fill it out?
When you're teaching and you're, like, instructing about, like, or talking about books or analysis or something, and then you go to write, and you go to writing, is there ever a time when you're teaching and you're like, oh, I can't, like, this doesn't actually apply or something?
Doesn't apply to, like, them as students, or doesn't apply to myself in
when
my
you're
writing, or
and you're like, that thing that I taught, like, I could not, I don't know what I'm actually trying to ask. Is there, like, a difference between instructing and, like, you personally writing?
I think there is a difference. It's an interesting question. I'm not sure that I could identify what the difference is. I think my learning process and my arc has actually kind of been the inverse, where the more I teach something, I think the better writer I've become about the thing that I teach. And then the more that I write that thing, the better I have gotten at teaching it too. So even before the body book, I wrote, maybe it was after the body book, I don't know. Like, but at some point I'd written a couple of essays, right? Mm-hmm. And I never had that much interest in writing nonfiction. I really love fiction. It's almost exclusively what I read. I read more nonfiction now, but it was kind of all I wanted to write. But I was teaching this just like, you know, intro freshman English class. And so I was teaching them how to write essays. And in that class, we would open up with like a personal essay. So I think after teaching it a few years, I think some part of me was like, I think I could turn a lot of these lessons back on myself and do them and not just preach them, but practice them. Right. And so I think they were pretty valuable lessons. I was like, oh, I have been teaching this pretty well. I feel like I am turning back on myself a bunch of my own lessons. And so then I would write some essays kind of like using my own instruction. And then the more essays I wrote, I would take that back into the classroom and sort of be like, oh, this is how I unlocked this thing, or this is how I figured out how to do this. And I could kind of talk them through, you know, not like the theory or anything, but talk them through the actual practical, like, this is what I do when I get stuck, or this is like how I push myself when something's too cliche, or this is, so.
I see a bunch of these essays like on Substack where they talk about students now are like somehow dumber or they can't read. Do you see that when you're teaching?
I mean, I don't know.
I don't really believe all that, but.
I don't really either, and I'm really careful about, like, that feels often like the kind of aging and nostalgia that I try to really, like, avoid and push back against, right? Like, on the one hand, my primary mode and writing theme is nostalgia. On the other hand, I try to never sort of be like, oh, things were better when, right?
Yeah.
And really, like, I try to fight that. I think there are some aspects for a variety of reasons. I mean, I think there's a generation or at least a sliver of a generation, certainly, that got real fucked up by COVID and in a multitude of ways, right? Like in lots of socialization ways that everybody talks about. I also think when they were in school on a computer screen in a really like formative years that needed to like teach them how to be a student and how to be thoughtful and how to kind of like do some of those skills. And I think just like learning through that screen, one is pretty hard even when you're focused. No. And then I think a lot of them were not paying that much attention. And I don't like not really of their own fault. Like, I don't know how much, you know, how much attention would I have been paying to my teacher's lectures on a screen when I was 16? Like,
yeah, it's incredibly difficult and like boring.
Yeah. And then, you know, like we're all incredibly like wrestling with AI right now and like what that means.
And I think there's also a difference between like reading and then trying to read like serious fiction.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think a lot of my students sort of struggle with things that I give them that are some, I don't even want to say more complicated so much as I want to say that are less like what they've seen in the past. Mm-hmm. Right. And so that struggle of like, this is a little unfamiliar. And so I'm unsure what to do with it. And so I definitely do see that. And on the one hand, you could sort of be old man and be like, kids these days aren't reading close enough. Mm-hmm. And again, I think there's ways that's true. And like social media and phones and TikTok have fucked up everybody's attention spans and ability to think deeply and interact deeply. But then also, like, when I was 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, if you'd given me a complicated text, I would have just been like, this is dumb. Why is this author being complicated for complicated sake? Right.
Yeah. So if you weren't teaching, do you think your writing would be different?
Probably. Yeah, that's a good question. And I don't know that I could say how or why. I don't think I would have become a nonfiction writer.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, and if I did, it would probably be very different. I think teaching is really what, like, if not pushed, like, and encouraged that, like, me wanting to try that and encourage that skill. Yeah.
So how do you come to the collection, A Kind of In Between? Because those are, like, a lot shorter pieces.
Yeah, so I think a lot of them I wrote during phases of being frustrated with longer works, and a lot of them was Buffalo stuff too, right? And I think that shorter stuff was valuable in that, like, I could sit down and write something and complete it, you know, in a way that, like, write a novel and you're just like, I don't know, I've been working on this novel for 5 years, and it feels good to sit down and be like, oh, I wrote a beginning, middle, and end. So that feels really good and satisfying. And then you send it out for publication and you get that kind of gratification. So most of A Kind of In Between was published on online journals. And I never thought any of it would get collected. I thought they were just fun, like, offshoots and side projects and whatever from trying to write books, and just, like, every now and then I would publish something on, you know, No Contact or X-Ray or whatever, and that was fun. And so it was often happening, one, when I was, like, trying to sell Buffalo and I couldn't, and I was, like, just getting down and kind of depressed and frustrated. It's like, okay, I'm gonna write a 900 word short and get it accepted and get that little dopamine boost. And then two, I had started a new novel, and sometimes I would, like, hit a wall, and so then I would maybe, like, take a break from the novel instead of beating my head against the wall, take a break and then, like, write one of these little offshoots. And so then what happened was just, like, I love Michael Wheaton and I love autofocus. And I really loved, I think at that point he'd maybe only put out the first four books, and I loved all four. And I was like, I want an autofocus book. I want a book that looks like that, because they look really cool. I want to work with Michael because he seems really cool. And at that point, like, we'd chatted. And so I just, like, collected all of these shorts I had and sent them to him. And I was like, maybe there's a book here. yeah.
So would you ever do, like, online workshops through any of your things if you weren't a teacher?
I've done a couple in the past, and I think they've been super fun. And for a while, I think really kind of, like, especially during the quarantine phase of the pandemic, that Word West was doing a bunch of classes. And so I took one through them that was themed around Dennis Johnson, and that was super fun and got me writing a bunch. And then I pitched to David, what if I do one themed around Jackass? And so we would each on our own watch one of the Jackass movies, and then we would, like, workshop for 2 hours. And the first hour would just be, like, a discussion of how our favorite moments from that week's Jackass movie. And then we would workshop two or three stories.
The writing was, like, connected to the movies?
Not really. Oh. I think kind of like via vibes, right?
Okay.
And so, which I think was really fun, which I think there was, like, a lot of interesting translation, right? How do I be inspired by this? Something I talk about with friends and in the classroom a bunch is sort of like drawing from and borrowing inspiration from everywhere. And then how do you translate that, one, into the page, and two, into your own thing? And so, you know, we would talk about sort of like a favorite skit in Jackass, and we would be like, what made that so great was that, you know, Johnny Knoxville, like, you know, punches Steve-O in the nuts or whatever, and it was hilarious. And it's like, that's the bit. But then what really makes it is then the camera pans and, like, everyone else is laughing too. And so it's not just, like, the prank or the being mean to each other, but it's the, like, community of them, right? And so then we would talk about, like, well, what's maybe ways of doing that on the page, right? Like, maybe you kind of have your version of the short story, like, set piece or big action thing or whatever, and then what does it mean to, like, spend some time with side characters or to, like, so we would talk about stuff like that.
So is that something, like, back in the early of the podcast we were talking about, like, ephemeral moments. Is that kind of something related to that, like Jackass, where they're all just fucking around?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, and like combining that too with your question, like, am I the Ric Flair of online journals or whatever? And like, I think at the heart,
you're more like Johnny Knoxville.
Maybe. Maybe, because he was never like the best at the stunts of any of them, mm-hmm. but he would like corral them, right? That's maybe often me. Like, I don't know how often like I'm the best writer in the group of writers, but I'm like, I'm trying to bring us together and like,
yeah,
promote us all and encourage.
What other roles would you assign to other writers?
I don't know. Who's the Steve-O? I don't know. Yeah.
I don't want to get in trouble. So.
And then I think maybe I would have different answers like 10 or 20 years ago when I was like in my 30s and 20s, right? Like now, I don't know, myself and most of us have like chilled out, right?
Yeah, I think like, some people have calmed down.
You know, certainly like when I was in grad school, I mean, part of what I loved about grad school was like I just like drank too much and was a shithead for 3 years. And like,
what's the most shithead thing you did?
I don't know. Just like being at a house party and like throwing beer bottles off the dude's like balcony and like getting him in trouble as there's like, you know, broken beer glass everywhere. And just like, you know, shit like that. Shit that like seems real funny at the time. And then looking back at some point here and just like, I don't know how funny it was versus I was just being an asshole.
So do you think if you went up on someone's house and started throwing beer bottles off, would that be like nostalgic for you?
No, I don't think so. I think nostalgic for me is like telling that story.
Okay.
I don't think I would ever do it now. And then I think my knee jerk was like, I think less doing it, it would be seeing somebody else do it. But I think now I would just be the old man who's like looking at that and being like, oh, you're being an asshole. Like, mm-hmm. whereas the telling the story is maybe my version of.
Was there like music playing?
Yeah, and I think it sucked, which was part of, I think, why I was like, this house party sucks. The dude who's hosting it sucks. He's playing shitty music. Like, I think
how'd you get on the house?
I think friends of friends, and just like.
They helped you up on the house.
Oh, like we were just like in the balcony, like, you know, it was like a house party that we walked in to, and then we would just like walk through and then out onto the balcony or whatever.
Okay. So do you think a book should be like Jackass?
So what started that answer, right, was like about Jackass, thinking about Ric Flair, thinking about the ephemeral nature of stuff, is I think my big belief for myself, and I'm often kind of an encourager of it for others, is just to have fun with it, right? I think I come to writing not really caring that much about like the history of literature or like what any of that means. And like, I want to read stuff that brings me joy and pleasure. And I say that like, you know, sometimes I'll read like a really heartbreaking or fucked up story and that brings me a kind of like joy and pleasure. It doesn't have to be like, you mm-hmm. know, this weird, like I only want to read like happy ending, joyful stuff. But like, there's a kind of joy in reading like somebody pull off an amazing story. Right. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you can even tell one when in just like the energy of the piece that like, oh, this piece feels like this author was having fun. And so I think that's one of my big encouragements for with the journals and with like with being on social media is really encouraging and trying to like maybe remind people that like having fun with all of this is allowed. And I, mm-hmm. I think, yeah.
Is that why you put that one book together with the essays about how to write a novel?
Yeah. I think it all just comes from like what would be fun. Right. Like I think, I was seeing a bunch of craft books and I was like, these all seem really smart. And also I'm not that interested in reading a craft book. I was thinking about how in the classroom, how often I talk about non-writing and then make the metaphor You know, I'm sort of like, how often in the classroom I talk about sort of, you know, like basketball players watching basketball and being sort of like, oh, I'm gonna borrow that move, and then sort of thinking about that in writing terms, or thinking about sort of lifting weights or going on a run or sort of learning an instrument, and sort of that, like, you know, it's all practice, it's all putting in the work, it's all, and it's not like all steady up either, right? Mm-hmm. And I talk about, you know, I've been running for a long time now, and I'm still not that fast, and I don't care that much about being that fast. But like, I don't know, it feels good when I run a little faster than the day I did before. But then sometimes I go out and I don't know why, but it's just like that run's a fucking struggle, you know, and I'm slow, yeah. and it doesn't feel right. And I'm just like, man, I guess I lost it. And then sometimes I'll go the very next day and it'll be like, it'll feel amazing. It's like, I don't know what the deal was yesterday, but I was off. And I think writing can feel like that too, right? You can have a really frustrating day and be like, oh, I lost it. I forgot how to write a story with yada, yada. And then maybe the next day you'll crush out 3,000 words all, and you'll be like, I don't know how that happened. And so I just like tweeted a joke. I was just sort of like, it would be fun to edit an anthology. It would be fun to edit a craft book that's called How to Write a Novel, but nothing, but it never mentions writing. And then Wheaton at Autofocus just replied and was like, I know a guy who could make that happen. Yeah. So it just started as like a dumb joke tweet. It wasn't even like a real idea. It was like, I don't know, this is 140 characters.
Well, it's almost like reading about another writer is like, a lot of people don't like that. I don't like that.
Yeah.
Like, you want to read about other shit.
Yeah, I think there's like, I think other people's process is kind of interesting to a degree, right? Mm-hmm. And then at some point you're just like, oh, I don't actually give a shit. Like, what do you, like, and maybe this circles all the way back a little bit to where we started. It's sort of like, once writers sort of fall into that, sometimes they fall into this sort of like, oh, here's how I talk about it smartly or something. And yeah. And I kind of want to just like listen to people chat and not sort of give me instruction.
Do you have a routine though? Have you made instructions for yourself for only
not,
do you go for the feeling or flow?
It's mostly feeling or flow. I think like the thing that I really like is going to a coffee shop and writing longhand for 2 to 3 hours. That's like, that's the thing, right? And so in grad school, I did that like every day.
Okay.
In the
when did you reach the point where like, oh, I have to do longhand? Because I do have a problem typing. I think longhand would be better, but I don't like want to do it. I should.
Maybe in grad school. I don't remember if I did before grad school.
It just comes out more freely.
Yes. Yeah. I think for me, I figured out that it just really worked for me. You know, I think I can get hung up when typing on like move a couple things. One is like I can easily just get hung up on being on a screen and flipping over to email or all this. And so I think for a long time I had, you know, apps that would like lock me down and take me offline. And I would just write, I would turn that on for like 2 or 3 hours and I would just write. But then also maybe even more than the distraction, I would just get like hung up on sentences and get hung up on like, oh, this isn't worded right. And I would just keep at it trying to word it right. Or like, cutting and pasting. It's like my favorite kind of revision. I love playing with organization and structure and moving stuff around.
Yeah.
Like that's not beneficial when I'm drafting, right? When I'm drafting, I want to be, I want that forward momentum of a road trip. Mm-hmm. And so longhand really does that. Like I'm not really stuck like trying to fix shit. Like sometimes I'll X stuff out and I'll like draw arrows and be like, oh, there's a new idea here. But for the most part, I'm just like writing and pushing forward.
And do you feel like one, when you like get a journal, you have to fill it all the way through?
I think I usually do. I write on like legal pads. Mm-hmm. And so they're not fancy. They're not like, you know, I have I also keep like a slightly fancier Moleskine that I have like a daily to-do list in. But like my actual prose is generally just in a legal pad, and then I get to the end of that, and then I get a new one. Yeah.
And then when you're working on one project, are you just working on that, or are you working on multiple?
A little bit of both. I think when one thing's going really well, I focus on it.
Mm-hmm.
But also I'm not precious about it. And so if I have a really great idea for a side thing, I'll hop out and do that. Or if I'm especially stuck, maybe I'll be like, okay, what's a short thing I can write? I'm never really, I don't think, ever really working on like two long sustained things at once.
Mm-hmm.
But I am often sort of like hitting pause and like doing a little side project, flash fiction or whatever.
When you go to the coffee shop, what are you buying?
Buying a latte usually. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes like a scone.
And then where are you sitting, like along the wall, or do you sit like out in the open?
Yeah. So my favorite coffee shop here in town now has like a counter window, or like a table, like a floating table up against the wall in front of the window. So mm-hmm. that's my real like ideal, is if there's space there, I sit there, I write, I can look up and sort of like look outside. And so that's maybe my ideal writing space.
If there's someone in your seat, does that just like ruin the day?
So my favorite coffee shop in town, I think the last two, maybe three times I went, there were no open seats.
Oh, shit.
And I was like, fuck. Mm-hmm. And so I went to a different place, and I got some good writing done there, but it was kind of a bummer. It was like, oh, I'm not that, like, you know, superstitious or particular, but it was like, man, I say I'm not that particular, but also sometimes I guess I am. And I was like, man, I really like the vibes of this mm-hmm. shop. And this other one just like doesn't feel right for writing, but.
Are you using a pen or your pencil?
Yeah, a pen. And I switched recently. I've always been the Pilot G2.
Mm-hmm.
But then more recently I've been using this Pilot Precise V5.
So, how many do you take with you?
A couple.
A couple?
And there's such a pleasure. It rarely happens when I'm out, but that pleasure of when you finish a pen and you've got to like toss it and move to the second one. I tweeted this once, and then like a couple of people gave me shit for like filling landmines with waste. And then I like,
really?
Yeah. I mean, you know,
jeez.
They were like, you should be using fountain pens. They're like, I was like, I don't know. I throw like three pens away a year. And there's such a pleasure in it, right? Of being like, oh, I used up all this ink sort of writing my dumb little words.
Are you like hunched over when you sit down to write? You get that creak in your arm.
I think I'm probably sitting more or less like this.
Okay. Does your arm hurt? It happens with me. And then sometimes I sweat and then it goes on the page.
Yeah. I don't think so. I think, and maybe this sounds so dumb to say, but also so true, like many things that are both incredibly dumb to say out loud, and also like there's a real truth there. It's just like, I think I've like built that muscle, right?
Yeah.
And so often when I'm talking to people who don't write longhand, then they're like, man, I just couldn't. I wouldn't be able to read my writing, or like my hand gets so tired after 5 minutes or whatever. It's like, I don't know, to some degree I probably did too. I got better at reading my own writing, and then also, I don't know, I've been writing longhand for 15, 17 years. I think my hand and my arm are just like, this is what we do.
So it goes away, you're saying, if I keep
doing
it?
Yeah.
How long do I have to keep doing it before it goes away?
Oh, I don't know. Like, ask 2008 Aaron, and maybe he'll know. At this point, it's like, I don't know. It's like when I, you know, again, kind of back to when I'm swinging my kettlebell, or when I'm going on runs, when I'm doing it like regularly, I can go out and do it, and then like it feels like I was active, but I'm not like sore or in pain or anything. But then I don't do it for a month, and my semester got really busy. It ended on Tuesday, so yesterday I went out on a longer run, and I hadn't been in a few weeks. and I'm feeling it today, mm-hmm. right? And it's just sort of like, oh, when I'm in the middle of going, you know, 3 to 5 times a week, like I don't feel it the next day because it's just sort of my body's like, this is what we do. So it's probably to some degree kind of, I think writing would be some version of that.
Are you writing while you're running in your head?
Sometimes. I think one of the things, maybe the big thing that I love about writing or about running is that I don't think about anything. Mm-hmm. And so more than the run itself, what I really love about running is just like zoning out to the world and being kind and feeling kind of blank for an hour. That said, when you do go kind of blank and you are a writer or an artist, sometimes that's when the shit happens, right? So there's definitely been, I mean, I've figured out pretty big novel, quote unquote, problems on runs and long bike rides. I've had ideas for stories. I've like more or less, quote unquote, written full stories where like I get home and I'm like, for the last hour, I was just like circling over these sentences over and over and over. And if it's a short enough piece and I can contain it, then, you know, I've gotten home and put down a draft. And like some of those were probably published almost more or less like as they came out in first draft. But I'm not even like they weren't total first draft. It's like I'd mostly figured it all out, you know, on mile 5 or whatever.
Have you ever thought about going on a hike with a notepad and writing while you're walking?
No, I don't want the I think I'm a fan of when I can getting away from responsibility.
Oh.
Right? Like I don't want to take my work with me. And so I think some of it is like if I'm on a hike or if I'm on a run, I want to just like be on a hike or on the run.
You know. Do you see it as a responsibility?
Sometimes self-appointed, which is like, you know, I mean, nobody like it isn't. And like, I think at some point I do kind of like feel a little like guilty if I haven't been or whatever. Mm-hmm. Right. Do you?
I don't write.
No, you don't at all?
Only in workshops.
Okay. And then what brought you to interviewing? I feel like for the most part, the only people that give as much of a shit about writing as you do is other writers. Like,
yeah.
Why, what do you like or what do you get out of doing these interviews?
Well, I live in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I don't have like a class that I go to. So I get to keep talking about writing and reading. Otherwise I get to meet people that I would never meet.
Yeah.
Cause like the first time I actually like went and met people was like last year, like in Philadelphia. And like, otherwise that was kind of the point of the podcast where it was like, I actually got to talk to people I would never ever talk to.
Yeah.
Cause I never imagined myself actually going and meeting anyone.
Yeah. Does doing them make you want to write more or?
I think about it more. Yeah.
Yeah.
But like when I sit down and write, I like, it's like, what's writing versus just sitting down and writing, I guess.
Do you see it? You see a distinction between the two?
Between my own writing and I do.
Yeah.
Cause I'm like, this is bullshit. This isn't like something that would come out, you know?
Yeah.
In a magazine, I guess. Like, when do I reach that point where like, oh, this is publishable? I never see that. I never see that point in mine. I never know when the end is.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. I talk about sort of versions of that in my class sometimes. I think sometimes my students have versions of that, right? And there's this really great Ira Glass quote about the gap. I think it's called the gap, right?
About the taste, yeah.
Yeah. Yes, and I think about that all the time. I think about it sometimes with myself. I think about it with my students. I think about it like early on when I started Hobart, I feel like for a lot of years there, I didn't write a ton. Well, I think maybe initially I wrote a ton because it was like I'm filling my life with this world, right? And so that's like doing the journals, encouraging me to write. But then I think at some point I got a little similarly like hung up on it, like being like, oh, I'm all of these people are sending me great stories and I'm publishing them and they're all better than what I'm writing.
Mm-hmm.
Why would I spend my time writing this not great thing mm-hmm. when I could also be spending my time publishing great things? And I think that found me, that kind of froze me some for sure. And then at some point I was just like, I got to write a bunch of the bad shit to then get the great thing. Yeah.
Yeah. How long did that take? How many bad pieces did you put out before you got something that you felt was good?
I don't know. And it's constantly like, I don't know. I feel like I've had a bunch of little breakthroughs along the way where I sort of like, and so it's so hard looking back now. And, but I think I'm often, if not always, especially now, feeling like the thing that I'm writing now is the best thing I've written. Right.
Yeah. So, I hear that a lot. Like the last thing someone wrote was like the best thing.
Yeah. And so I look back at some of those earlier books and earlier publications. I'm like, I'm still proud of them. And I was incredibly proud of them at the time. But like, I think this new one's way better. Right. And I was mm-hmm. like, oh, I really feel like I kind of unlocked something. And that's maybe happened in like a handful of tiers. I think this most recent one was, I don't know, the last few years, even especially kind of, I feel like I leveled up and I feel like, oh, I really figured out what I can do. I think I spent a lot of time being like, oh, I can't write a Brian Evanson story as good as Brian Evanson. And mm-hmm. I can't write a Kevin Maloney story as good as I can, as good as Kevin Maloney's, right? And I can't write an Amelia Gray story as good as Amelia. So I spent a bunch of years sort of like frustrated about that, I think. And then I think at some point I was like, you know, when I do it well, an Aaron Birch story can be really good.
Yeah.
But I think to some degree I had to figure out what that was and then allow it of myself, maybe.
So your favorite story is a Dennis Johnson story. Why is it your favorite?
Man, I think he epitomizes what I love about good writing and maybe short stories especially, because I think short stories can do this in a way that's so much harder for novels, which is to just like feel like just good, pure storytelling, like somebody sitting with you at the bar, telling you this amazing story. Right. And so it feels like that, but also it feels like the tightest version of that, and yet also not overworked, but then also with every now and then, just frequently enough, just like a razor sharp banger sentence or paragraph even. Right. Mm. And so I think that's the thing I love in a story. It's like, I kind of want to be wrapped up in just like a funny, well-told, engaging, interesting, like kind of anecdotal story that mm-hmm. then every now and then can like reach into this magician's top hat or reach up into the heavens and then just be like, yeah, but then look at this sentence.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Has there ever been a story that's completely changed your perspective on life and made you like look at life differently?
That's a good question. I think so. I'm not sure that like I have a crystal clear answer for it. I think there's probably better versions of this, but the most recent one that comes to mind is I just taught on the last day of class in my advanced fiction class. I taught this Robert Coover story, Going for a Beer, right, which is I think one of my favorite stories of the century. One of my 25 of 25. And I think I loved it immediately. I think it came out in 2011. I was a New Yorker subscriber. I read it that week and was just like wowed. And I think for a couple reasons. And one was just like, I'd never read anything like it. I just like the way it speeds through time. I was just like, oh, I didn't know a story could do that, right? And going back, like, I love that in any art, right? Going back to music, going back to movies. I think, you know, I think about being 16 and seeing Pulp Fiction in the movie theater and being like, holy shit, I didn't know you could do that. Like, my life is different now, right? And so I think there was something in that Coover story that was like, oh, you can do this. And if you can do this, then maybe anything's possible. But then also, so almost none of my students really connected with this story. And I think one is, going back to that earlier, maybe it was like too unlike what they'd read before and they didn't quite know what to do with it. But then also I think a big part of it is the story's really about aging and this man at the end of his life kind of being like, oh, life flew by and it happened at me and now it's over. And I think, you know, all these students who are 20, it's like, I don't know if that's how life feels. And also, like, why didn't you do more? Right. And I was like, well, I don't, sometimes that is how life feels. And so I don't know if it, I forget exactly your question, but like reframed how I thought about life or something. I don't know that it quite did that, but I think it makes me realize that speed of life in a way of just sort of being like, that is just a reminder to like appreciate life and appreciate the little things and sort of like, if you want to do something, you make yourself do it and sort of to try to,
I feel like every question I ask you, you always end it on a great point that I could end the podcast with. So I'm gonna end the podcast there.
Okay. We're
going about 90 minutes. But thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for the books.
Yeah, thanks so much for the great questions. I think, it was such a great chat.
Thank you, man.
Cool.
I'll see you.
All right, later, bud.
Later. And that was Aaron Birch. Lo-Fi Lit.